From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, white smoke begins to emerge from the U.S. Capitol. Could the political impasse in Washington be over?
This legislation also funds the government through January 15th and averts default through February 7th.
Also today, the government shutdown didn't stop the National Security Agency from snooping on the email address books of some Americans. Russia apologizes to the Netherlands after a Dutch diplomat is beaten up in Moscow. And the battle to save the U.S. Post Office as waged in Berkeley, California.
People relate to the Postal Service in a very personal way. In small communities in particular, the Post Office is the center of that community.
That's all coming up on today's edition of FSN Reports after our summary of the headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. The leadership of the U.S. Senate has announced a bipartisan deal to end the U.S. government shutdown until January 15th and extend the debt ceiling through February 7th. Now, the U.S. House of Representatives must pass the legislation and send it back to the U.S. Senate for final approval before U.S. President Barack Obama signs it into law. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has an update.
The deal was announced from the floor of the U.S. Senate. Majority Leader Harry Reid told fellow lawmakers the agreement has three key points. The U.S. government would remain open through January 15th. The government's borrowing authority would be extended through February 7th, and lawmakers must commit to a committee to actually address the many budget questions.
But in the end, political adversaries set aside their differences and disagreements to prevent that disaster. I thank the Republican leader for his diligent efforts to reach this important agreement.
While senators are emphasizing how it's time for a compromise and it's time for a vote, it is unclear if the U.S. House of Representatives will pass the Senate legislation. And to reach President Obama's desk and actually end the crisis, both chambers must vote on the same bill. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
U.S.-Egypt relations are in turmoil following Washington's decision to suspend hundreds of millions of dollars worth of military aid last week over the July military coup that ousted former President Mohamed Morsi. That's according to the country's foreign minister, Nabil Fahmy, who told the state-run newspaper Al-Haram that relations are under strain. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Washington's decision to suspend the delivery of tanks, helicopters and fighter jets to Egypt followed several weeks of intense debate over whether to suspend aid to Egypt over the ouster of Mohamed Morsi, the country's first democratically elected president. The White House initially refused to call the July coup a coup for fear of triggering an automatic cut in aid under U.S. law. But last week, Washington changed its mind, saying the decision reflected its frustration with the direction the Egyptian army had taken, saying aid would be fully restored if Egypt took enough steps to restore democracy. Now the country's foreign minister says relations are under strain. But with the Obama administration dealing with the ongoing political crisis at home, Washington's foreign policy priorities have taken a back seat. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
An airport employee has been arrested in connection with the dry ice explosions at Los Angeles International Airport. DiCarlo Bennett, who works for airport ground handling company ServiceAir, has been taken into custody. Over the last 24 hours, two dry ice bombs exploded in restricted areas of the airport. One detonated in an employee bathroom, the other on the tarmac near aircraft. Police don't believe this is an act of terrorism, but maybe the work of a disgruntled employee. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A Dutch diplomat was beaten up by two men after they forced their way into his Moscow apartment. The attack came after the arrest of a Russian diplomat in the Netherlands and marks the latest event in an increasingly strained relationship between the two nations. Russian officials said the attack was regrettable, while the Dutch government is demanding a full investigation. The world-famous England-based graffiti artist Banksy has spent the month of October creating artwork on the streets of New York City and chronicling the work through newly created Instagram and YouTube accounts. Despite his high-profile status, the artist's real identity still remains a mystery. From New York, Ira Spitzer has more.
New York City is considered by many to be the birthplace of graffiti artwork, and this month, one of its most famous modern practitioners has joined the fray. The England-based graffiti artist Banksy has made the city into his canvas for over a dozen works of art in a month-long show which he has titled Better Out Than In. His residency has caused a number of reactions, including one of his pieces being painted over immediately by an angry landlord, and local residents charging curiosity seekers and art aficionados a fee to view a particular piece. One video posted to Banksy's YouTube account shows original but unlabeled Banksy artwork being sold in Central Park for $60 each. Only a few people purchase works over the course of the day, which are now probably worth tens of thousands of dollars. This is the first time that the elusive artist has had a social media account. Ira Spitzer, New York.
A Lao Airlines passenger plane has crashed as it prepared to land during heavy rain and strong winds in southern Laos, killing dozens of passengers, according to airline officials. According to the airline head, 49 people, including 44 passengers, were killed in the crash, which occurred as the plane was preparing to land at Pak Si Airport near the border with Thailand. The airline president claims gusts from the remnants of Typhoon Nari caused the pilots to lose control of the aircraft. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Kevin McAleese reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. It may, just may, all be over. After days of brinksmanship and name-calling, Congress is poised finally to raise the country's debt ceiling, end the government shutdown, and fire the starting gun on all-encompassing budget negotiations that will run through until the end of the year and into the early part of 2014. Democrats and Republicans in the Senate today celebrated the compromise measure that they say can get the wheels of government moving again, and Tea Party support Republicans in the House of Representatives seemed resigned to accepting that the measure will pass in their chamber as well, notwithstanding their opposition. With today's dramatic events on Capitol Hill, reporter Alice Ulstein.
The hallways of the U.S. Capitol were crowded Wednesday as reporters and cameramen pushed and shoved to be the first to learn from lawmakers the details of the deal reached to avert the nation's first ever debt ceiling default. After hours of closed-door meetings, Majority Leader Harry Reid laid out the details on the Senate floor.
As part of our agreement, in order to assure Congress continues the work of setting this country on a path of fiscal sustainability, this legislation instructs leaders to name conferees to a budget conference committee. This legislation also funds the government through January 15th and averts default through February 7th. During which time we can work toward a long-term budget agreement that prevents these frequent crises.
The deal does not include any of the demands originally made by Republicans, such as defunding or delaying the Affordable Care Act, stripping lawmakers and their staff of subsidized health plans, or repealing the medical device tax. It does include a Democratic priority, back pay for all federal workers furloughed during the now 16-day-long government shutdown. Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell acknowledged that the plan includes far less than his party had hoped for, and his speech Wednesday focused on the only thing Republicans did win, a short-term government funding measure that keeps the deep sequester cuts in place.
Let's not understate the importance of the Budget Control Act or the importance of the fight to preserve it.
Other Senate Republicans, including North Dakota's John Hoeven, focused on the bill's creation of a new budget conference, tasked with agreeing on more deep cuts by mid-December.
Trying to get a process in place to get savings and reforms so we can address the underlying drivers of our debt and deficit. So that's important.
But the last time Congress set up such a conference, it failed to reach an agreement by its deadline, triggering last year's sequester cuts that Republicans have alternately praised and condemned. If this new committee also fails, the country could be facing the threat of another shutdown and another debt ceiling default in just a few months. But the priority now is getting the bill through both chambers of Congress and to the Oval Office, where President Obama has promised to sign it as soon as possible. South Carolina Republican Rick Scott is one of many who would prefer House Speaker John Boehner to act first.
From a procedural standpoint, if you're looking for the most expeditious route, the House has to go first. So I think it's probably from a timing perspective, it's the most important thing.
Even if the bill passes by Thursday's deadline, the White House and many members of Congress say the fiscal showdown has done lasting damage to the country's economy and international standing. Maine Republican Susan Collins says it has also caused many Americans to lose faith in their own government.
I don't think that this was constructive in any way.
Other lawmakers say they're concerned about the damage that's been done to the democratic process. Virginia Democrat Jim Moran held events this week to call attention to and protest a rule change quietly pushed through by House Republicans at the beginning of the government shutdown, which made Majority Leader Eric Cantor the only member of the House who could call a vote on the Senate's original bill.
That single line precluded any other member of the House from being able to end the government shutdown. Now that is an historic change.
Moran and other lawmakers express concern that this change limiting the rights of most members sets a bad precedent for future debates. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Well, the shutdown may be moving into its final phase, but 3 weeks in, it's had a lasting impact. America's national parks were among the areas closed by the standoff, and in Washington, D.C., that included the World War II Memorial. Nonetheless, veterans have continued to gather there in protest, both at the closure of the site itself and at the effect the shutdown's been having on military families. Some say the handling of the whole affair could even affect how they cast their votes in next year's midterm elections. FSN's Lorna Shaddock reports.
I'm at America's World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., a national park and a national place of homage to those who've made the ultimate sacrifice. But veterans have been gathering here not just to pay tribute to fallen comrades. Even with light at the end of the long government shutdown tunnel, they and their families have been feeling the pinch, and they're not happy about it. Jonathan Megwald is a veteran of Operation Enduring Freedom and is now an Army reservist. For him, it's been 3 weeks of anxiety.
My income's been brought down to zero. I collect the GI Bill, I'm a federal employee, and I'm a reservist. So once the government shutdown happened, everything kind of went away.
Colonel Herb Rosenbleith is president of the military coalition. He says the shutdown, resolved or not, left veterans feeling neglected.
They're angry, outraged, disappointed, and surprised that the government would do this. Because as military servicemen, we protected the country. We thought they'd be there to protect us, and it's been disgraceful.
When asked who they blame specifically for the deadlock, most of the veterans, despite their anger, weren't ready to point the finger at specific political parties. They say the political atmosphere in general is harmful. Jonathan Megwald again.
I blame the way politics has kind of been evolving in the last few years. It seems as though it's become way more polarized than it ever has been. And I think that those that continuously suffer are the ones that are on the opposite side of the whole policy telescope, those who need the government to work the most.
But Steve Gonzalez from the American Legion says even if he's not apportioning blame right now, the shutdown could well affect how he and his comrades vote in next year's midterms.
2014 is an election year. Many members of Congress will be up for election, and this also will show to many of our members that maybe they need to reconsider how they're voting and ensuring that when we do elect members of Congress as public servants, that they're doing right by service members and veterans.
Those who've been meeting here at the World War II Memorial have been keen to keep party politics out of their protest. This is about military families and benefits and respect for veterans, they say. But it's clear that they're hurt, both materially and psychologically, by the effects of the shutdown. And they won't forget that when they head to the ballot boxes in 2014. Lorna Shaddock, Washington.
Now, even though parts of the US government have been shut down, the National Security Agency has been busy harvesting vast amounts of personal contact information from email and instant messaging accounts. According to secret documents released by fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden, the agency has been collecting the records overseas, with Americans among those targeted. Speaking to FSN's Kevin McAleese, Rachel Levinson-Waldman from Washington's Brennan Center for Justice says it's another clear abuse of basic American rights.
The reason is that while, as you say, the NSA is targeting overseas, there's a lot of Americans' communications getting swept up as well. And that could happen in a few different ways. One is sort of the most basic, Americans traveling or living overseas. Their information could then get included just the same way that anyone else overseas. Another way is an American who communicates with somebody who's being targeted, so their contact information might be in, you know, an address list or a buddy list of somebody overseas. And the third way, and I think this is the one that in some ways is most troubling to people because it's so broad, is simply that the way a lot of companies operate today, you think about Google, Facebook, these really major kind of data and communications companies, they have servers overseas. They are transmitting so much data that some of it has to go through overseas points so they can process all of it. And by virtue of the fact that it kind of touches overseas points, that information could get swept up as well.
We had the NSA director, Keith B. Alexander, saying that, you know, you need a haystack to find a needle.
You know, I think some of the NSA's own documents in some ways are the best response to Director Alexander. The NSA's internal documents have said we are getting so much information in a lot of cases that we don't know what to do with it. So I think they say that something like 20% of the collection that they were doing in 2012 was what they call ownerless address books. They don't know who the owner is. The NSA itself says they're doing excessive collection, gross over collection. And what we know from a lot of different contexts, from reviews of other of attacks, of near attacks, is that almost uniformly one of the major sort of errors leading up is that there's too much information, that it's too hard for the intelligence agencies, for the FBI, you name it, to sift through what they already have. And so this sort of dragnet collection seems to get in the way more than anything. Certainly in this country and in other countries as well, unfortunately, what we have is a history of abuse of information that's gathered sort of for domestic security reasons.
Rachel Levinson-Waldman from Washington's Brennan Center for Justice, talking to FSN's Kevin McAleese. This is FSN Reports. The Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, got some mixed news today from the country's judiciary. The Court of Appeals upheld his recent conviction on charges of embezzlement, but suspended the 5-year jail sentence he was due to begin soon. Also in Russia today, the government expressed its regrets to the government of the Netherlands after a Dutch diplomat was beaten up in his home by attackers claiming to be electricians. Two stories that I discussed earlier with FSN's Moscow bureau chief Anya Ardayeva, beginning with the legal decision with regard to Alexei Navalny.
Alexei Navalny is the most prominent anti-corruption blogger and the most prominent critic of the Kremlin in Russia at the moment. He is an opposition leader who gained his prominence after bringing a lot of people to the streets in the past few years, the biggest protests in 13 years of Vladimir Putin's rule. And the reason why this decision of the Russian appeals court to upheld a 5-year sentence and to suspend his sentence at the same time is important because it means that the opposition leader will not be jailed. He will have to report to police twice a month, and most likely he will not be able to run in the next presidential election in Russia in 2018. And this is something that Alexei Navalny said he was going to do. He was going to run for presidency. Alexei Navalny denied all the charges that were presented to him and said he was prosecuted for political reasons and that he would continue appealing his sentence. He ran for the post of Moscow mayor in September, coming second with 27% of the vote. So widespread opinion here in Russia is that the court has decided to suspend his sentence to avoid further unrest among his multiple supporters in Russia.
Now, the Russian government is often accused of meddling with judicial decisions. The Russian government always denies that it does meddle with those judicial decisions. But does this decision send any kind of a message to the country's opposition?
Well, the main message that it is sending to the country's opposition is that if the Russian justice system decides to charge someone with something, and if this certain someone is involved in political activity, this person would most likely be found guilty. Now, the court had decided to suspend the sentence, which means that the Russian officials at this point are kind of wary of more protests that could emerge in Moscow if Alexei Navalny goes to jail.
All right, and let's talk about the other story that's making headlines in Moscow today. And it sounds like an episode from a Cold War spy novel, a Dutch diplomat beaten up in his own apartment in Russia.
The Russian Foreign Ministry identified the Dutch diplomat as Onno Elderenbosch. He works as a deputy chief of mission at the Moscow embassy. The Russian ministry spokesman, Alexander Lukashevich, expressed regrets in connection with the incident and said that the Russian investigators will do everything possible to find the attackers. Now, what is important is that this incident comes just 10 days after the arrest of the Russian diplomat Dmitry Borodin in The Hague. It was reported that he was arrested because the police had traced a car involved in an accident to the diplomat's home. The diplomat said he was arrested, beaten, and then released without being offered any explanation, and that infuriated Moscow, which accused Amsterdam of violating the Vienna Convention. The Dutch foreign minister apologized to Moscow for the detention of Dmitry Borodin and said that the envoy's right to diplomatic immunity had indeed been violated. Now, 10 days later, here in Moscow, the Dutch diplomat says he was slightly injured after two people broke into his apartment, pushed him to the floor, and tied up with tape. Now, photos obtained by the Russian website Life News that were showed on Russian TV and that were reportedly taken inside the diplomat's apartment show a heart written in lipstick on a mirror and the abbreviation LGBT written in Russian. Now, it's impossible just yet to confirm that this photo is authentic. The Dutch have been very critical of Russia's new law aimed at banning gay propaganda. And in April, the mayor of Amsterdam even declined to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin during his visit to the Netherlands.
There will be those, Anya, who say that this has all the hallmarks of an officially sanctioned attack, and yet the government is officially distancing itself from it.
The interesting part in this is whether those attackers will ever be found. That is a big question, because in the previous attacks of this kind in Moscow, on journalists, on diplomats, on human rights activists, the assailants are almost never found and never prosecuted.
FSN's Moscow Bureau Chief Anya Ardayeva on the line from the Russian capital. Today saw a second day of key talks over Iran's nuclear program in Geneva between world powers and Iranian officials. And Iranian media sources are suggesting lower uranium enrichment levels could be part of a deal which the nation hopes will see an easing of tough US-led sanctions. The talks are the first since the election of President Hassan Rouhani, who has been credited with a shift in tone over the issue. For one take on the discussions with Iran, FSN's Mary McCarthy talked to Iranian-born author Reza Aslan, who says while the turnaround is positive, there's still a long road ahead.
These conversations are just starting. They're going to take a long time. There's a lot of mistrust on both sides, a lot of skepticism, and a lot of reason to not be necessarily optimistic that this will go anywhere. But we do have an opportunity here. There is a difference in these conversations that we haven't seen before, a different emphasis both on the American side and on the Iranian side. The path is before us for a breakthrough, not just in the nuclear negotiations, but for a kind of rapprochement between the United States and Iran. But it's going to require patience, diligence, and there are people on both sides who do not want this negotiation to succeed. There are vested interests in the United States, as in the Islamic Republic of Iran, who actually benefit from this ongoing distrust, this ongoing conflict between the Iranians and the Americans, and will do everything in their power to keep negotiations from succeeding. They cannot be allowed to succeed.
And meanwhile, you have Israel, who's saying, you know, wait, nothing has changed. That, well, this new president is a wolf in sheep's clothing.
That's one of the vested interests that I'm referring to. I mean, Israel, for its own domestic reasons, does not want to see any kind of rapprochement between the U.S. And Iran. But that's also true of Saudi Arabia. I mean, oftentimes, I think when people talk about the obstacles in the way of Iranian and American engagement, Israel always comes up because that's an easy one. It's front and center. But what is a far greater obstacle to American and Iranian rapprochement is Saudi Arabia. After all, we get 60% of our foreign oil from Saudi Arabia. Iran sits on the second largest supply of natural gas and oil on the planet. A warming of ties between the Americans and the Iranians would be very bad for the Saudi bottom line, and they have done everything in their power over the last three decades to make sure that that never happens. And they are working hard to continue to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Most people would say that the most pressing issue in the Middle East these days is Syria. What would you like to see happen there?
The civil war has degenerated to a place now where it's hard to imagine how we can come out of this without further bloodshed. I mean, basically, what I think the American administration has decided is that they prefer to see Bashar al-Assad stay in power than deal with what comes next, which is why you don't hear anyone in the Obama administration speaking the way that they were speaking 18 months ago, talking about Assad's days are numbered, that he needs to be removed from office. It's been a long time since anyone at the State Department made that kind of message or presented that kind of message when it comes to Syria. We waited too long, I think, for a truly robust response to this conflict, and now the conflict has taken on a life of its own.
The pugnacious thoughts of Reza Aslan, talking there to FSN's Mary McCarthy. Now, the United States Postal Service is scrambling to close a $20 billion budget gap this year. The service is considering several desperate plans to shore up its financial future, including plans to sell dozens of iconic post office buildings. Those plans have been met with a barrage of criticism from the American public, and amongst the most vocal, post office patrons in Berkeley, California. FSN's Rachel Silverman has the story.
The post office holds a special place in the American imagination. Even in the 21st century, Americans still like to think of their post office as a place where neighbors gather and have a sense of community. Post office spokesman Augustine Ruiz says some people come to the post office just to chat.
People relate to the Postal Service in a very personal way. Their letter carrier on the street, they know them by the first name. The person that they meet across the counter, they get to know that person. And in small communities in particular, the post office is the center of that community.
At the downtown Berkeley post office, people still come to buy stamps, pay bills, and send packages. And from time to time, groups of school children come to visit to learn how to mail a letter the old-fashioned way. But as email and e-commerce have become more ubiquitous, letter carriers are moving about 25% less mail today than they did just 5 years ago. Spokesman Augustine Ruiz says far fewer people walk into post offices like this one to do their business.
The post office is not dying, but it's on life support.
Like many post office buildings across the country, Berkeley's was built nearly a century ago when the U.S. Postal Service was in its prime. This building is home to important works of art commissioned by the U.S. government during the Great Depression. And the residents of Berkeley, birthplace to the student unrest a generation ago and still named the People's Republic of Berkeley, are not about to submit quietly to the loss of a beloved institution. Berkeley citizens formed a group called Save the Berkeley Post Office to stop the sale. Activist Harvey Smith says the sale is a thinly disguised attempt to privatize a postal service which should be subsidized by the government.
There's an agenda, and the agenda is to privatize the post office, to eliminate the union jobs, and to give that business over to private companies.
Susan Hammer worked for the Postal Service for 39 years. She's upset at what the loss of the Berkeley Post Office building and others like it will mean.
It represents an amazing loss of connectivity to family, friends, and the larger community.
Berkeley's iconic downtown post office building went on the market a few days ago with no price listed. City leaders say they're considering suing the Postal Service to stop any sale from going forward. Rachel Silverman, Berkeley, California.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us. Our address is reports@featurestory.com. Coming up tomorrow, what does the rest of the world think of the US in the aftermath of the government shutdown? That's Thursday. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington, alongside producer Kevin McAleese. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.